Accession number 19990, reel 10.
Chief Technician Barry Roper, reel 10. You're saying you didn't take part in any active air sea rescue missions.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after the Suez Crisis? Did you resume internal security?
Oh yes.
In the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we were sort of involved until the very end, and you see, during this time we'd had Field Marshal Harding in charge, and it changed from being a military solution to a political solution, and then we got Hugh Foote.
And was that detectable at Chesh?
Oh yes, yes, yeah, yes. I mean. It was John Harding that got us there in the first place. He wanted helicopters, and the CO that formed it all, he pioneered night flying with helicopters. Which there were a number of things that we did out there. Of course, none of these type of things had been done before, although Malaya, of course, were doing similar things at the same time.
Were you aware of things going on in Malaya while you were in Cyprus?
No, not really.
So ideas weren't filtering back
to
Malaya?
No, no, because, of course, there'd been Korea before my time in Cyprus. We'd had the Korean bit, and we'd had Malaya building up, but we were very much concentrated on our own problems.
Your local theatre.
And people would come up with ideas, and they'd be tried bits and pieces and doing things different ways.
Do you remember any of those new procedures or ideas in particular?
Now then. Well, it was mainly to do with the sort of approach to different operations, where procedures were laid down, but we decided that it was easier or safer to do it in a certain way. And of course, during this time, there were people coming out from the UK, boffins, and I can remember fitting crop spraying equipment to a sycamore. And it was filled with a rather suspicious-looking liquid. And we never did realise... I don't think it was defoliation. It was some either scent which they could then detect if a person had been in a certain area where he shouldn't have been. But all that sort of thing went on.
You're saying that the... crop spraying equipment was filled with a highly scented liquid of some sort.
It was sort of, well, to me, it smelt of pear drops. And although we were told to wear rubber gloves when refueling the tanks and things, we didn't wear protective suits or anything. But it may well have been something that we should have been wearing, protective suits.
Do you know where you sprayed that stuff, where it was delivered?
No, it was, it obviously, they went up into the hills, and the tank filled the whole of the rear fuselage, where the passengers would normally be. The helicopter, the Sycamore, has got 5 seats, 3 at the rear that are para seats, which just fold down, canvas seats that fold out of the wall, and then you've got the pilot's seat, which was a tall, high chair, and the navigator's seat at the front, which had a half-round back. And what you were able to do when you had troops in was to turn the seat round, the navigator's seat swiveled, so that you sat with your back to the windscreen, and it meant that you were facing your troops, and you could release your safety harness and walk straight out of the back of the aircraft either side. And it filled the whole of that rear bay. And I remember that the 2 footsteps that the pilot has a step to get into his side, and the navigator or winchman the other side. And I believe that we fitted up the spray heads to the two aircraft steps, and there was one or two pilots were involved in going out and spraying whatever they were spraying.
But you didn't get involved in any of those spraying.
I was never.
But was there anything else going on of that sort, modifications that you remember?
Well, yes, at time. You see, for instance, we'd take the ropes, the deplaning ropes, in with the aircraft were issued ladders, rope ladders, which rolled out of the aircraft, for, presumably for air sea rescue in this country. But we found they were useless, so we used it with our monkey tricks. Now this thing was lashed round the back of the pilot's chair, and then it went up to a fixture up behind the passengers' heads. This rope, sort of, to get it in to stow away, and so that it wouldn't end up going into the blades or anything if it was dangling. But I can't remember. Well, I can remember taking aircraft doors off for cable laying, and we on the Sycamore there's a sort of boot at the back. You can't get at it except when the aircraft is on the ground, and it has two doors, and it's handy for stowing suitcases or servicing equipment. And I can remember us taking those doors off and fixing up a reel for cable laying. Once again, you've got problems when you're doing anything like this, because if the aircraft flares, in other words, as it approaches a landing, its nose comes up to check its forward speed and the tail comes down. And if you've got anything trailing, then you get it in your tail rotor.
It can catch.
And things, you know, that you've got to sort of be very careful with modifications, because you might not realise it at the time, but you might be putting the aircraft in some sort of serious danger.
What was wrong with the rope ladders? Why weren't they useful for getting out of aircraft?
I think because of the equipment, if you watch troops, some would go out backwards, some would go out forwards, you know, and it was standardisation, but also the amount of equipment they've got, when they've got a rifle or they've got a spade or thing. I think that the single rope with knots was a better idea than the ladder.
Presumably it would take up less space inside the machine than the rope ladder. The rope ladder, you'd have two ropes, wouldn't you?
Yes, in step. Yeah. No, that's right. That is a point. But I can't ever remember even using it for the purpose it was intended, presumably for air sea rescue. I've never seen them used.
You mentioned night flying. Did you have anything to do with the development of that?
Well, the idea was that you would secure a strip of land that you had to make sure it was going to be clear, and then you put a tee out, and the pilot, because the leg of the tee was into wind, and so the pilot would be flying round, and he'd say, right, you'd go out, you'd put a tee out, and he would land with his nose wheel on the tee. And the problem is that you've got a landing lamp. Now, it's bad enough trying to judge your height when you can see, but at night, trying to know how close you are to the ground. And with the Sycamore, it was a tricycle undercarriage with a skid at the rear. And you get, there are things called vortex rings, which is the helicopter sits on a cushion of air. The downwash from the blades, and it sits on this air, that's what's holding it up. but occasionally you can get a rotation of the air and it goes round at the tips and presses down onto the thing, and the thing goes down in a...
It's pushed down by
pushed its own
down,
power. Yeah. And that's the vortex ring. Then you get the ground resonance. And this is a serious problem. As you are about to touch down, the centre of gravity would start to move and you'd bounce from one wheel to another. And unless you get yourself airborne very quickly or shut it down very quickly, the thing would just roll over. The centre of gravity would start to move out. It only has to move about an inch and a half.
It would capsize.
Yeah. And we had, on one occasion, whilst doing this monkey trick training, the pilot lifted the aircraft off, the troops got out, they ran away from the aircraft, and the man that was marshalling the aircraft gave the pilot the signal to land. But when he landed, his wheel landed on top of the rope. And so the young man went in and said to the pilot, "You're on the rope, can you lift off so I can get the rope out and put it back where it belonged, under the pilot's seat?" So the pilot lifted carefully off, and as he lifted off, he got resonance, and the aircraft went over. The blade, I'm not sure whether this was the occasion when we cut an RSM in half. He was a Marine RSM, and he cut his leg off, and his leg was only held by the muscle. And one of the Marines came along with his bayonet and just took the muscle off as well. A very bad business. The RSM lived, but minus his leg.
How far away was he when that happened? How far from the aircraft?
He, I would imagine, would be hit by a broken blade as the aircraft went over and the blades hit the ground.
They
break off, but I know it cut the RSM's leg almost clean off, and one of his troops finished the job. Pardon me. Yeah.
So, how could you? Was there any way which you could overcome this difficulty of getting down at night? Technical solutions.
Well, no. I mean, it was practice.
Yes.
And of course, when you're flying single engined, if you have an engine failure at night, we then got Shamouli flares, which were the first time I think these had been used. So we fitted little rocket launchers, if you like, to the side of the fuselage. And if a pilot got himself into trouble, either an engine failure at night, you could fire off this flare on a parachute, which illuminated the whole area for a matter of, 5 minutes. And in that 5 minutes, hopefully, he could get himself down, be able to judge the height correctly, because you've got... If you check your downward speed too soon, the blades slow down so much they fold up like an umbrella, and you then hit the ground very hard. If you do the other thing, that you don't check it soon enough, you hit the ground too hard anyway, and your wheels come up round your ears. So you've got to more or less be spot on. What you're looking for is 15 to 20 feet above the ground. You then pull all the pitch on, and the aircraft should theoretically sink nicely to the ground without a bump.
What about navigation at night? Presumably that was much more difficult than navigation in daytime, because you wouldn't be able to see landmarks.
Funnily enough, on one occasion during the Suez crisis, we had been at Akrotiri all day, and we were setting off back in the evening. And it was dark, and we'd had a long day. And with the helicopter, it has a particular motion. It's sort of a rocking motion, and it's easy to nod off as a passenger, you know, this sort of constant sort of throbbing and this movement. If you're tired, you can nod off. And we were flying along, and I'd been talking to the pilot, but there was plenty to see, the lights in the mountain villages and things like this. Anyway, we're approaching, as I thought, Nicosia, lit up, and as we're approaching from the south, heading northwards, and what you did, you approached the town and then you turned left, and there was RAF Nicosia all lit up, you see, but we turned left and it wasn't there. And what had happened, the pilot had nodded off, and what we thought ahead of us was Nicosia was actually Famagusta. And we turned left, and it was a case of, well, that must be Nicosia, you know, because there was a lot of light. And, I mean, flying over, you were flying over a lot of forest, and of course, between Akrotiri and Nicosia is the high range, the Troodos and that area. And so you climbed up to the safe altitude where you knew you wouldn't run into anything. But,
flying on a bearing then, if you were doing that at night?
Oh yeah, I mean he'd be looking at his compass, but he'd nodded off, and I presume when he woke up, I mean, because pilots they sit there in a helicopter, and what they're doing is stirring the stick slightly to keep the aircraft. If you hold the stick rigid, you'd be buffeted. But all they do is sit there, and they've got the stick sort of stirring in the hand. And I mean, it's such a small island anyway. And as I say, navigation was really by lights. But you could, most of them knew sort of there were beacons and things like that. And we didn't have that sort of a problem.
Were you able to navigate? Could you navigate if necessary?
No. I was never called on to do that. But there was. We had to operate, in those days, we had SARA, which was a, now they call it SARBI, but the old SARA beacon. And we used to use this for, if you had someone hidden in an area, I mean, the idea was that if there was someone in the sea with a Mae West on, the SARA would, you could home in on them, you see. But it was also used for other... you could home in on anything that had a SARA going, very much in its infancy, and I do remember playing about with SARA. But
this was to get a fix on the position.
Yeah.
How accurate was that?
Well, what happened? You had a little tube, cathode ray type tube, and it had great thing, and you got a signal, and as you turned to the signal. It ended up, you've got a centre line and you've got a spirit level, if you like, and you aimed to get it equidistant either side of the centre line, and you carried on flying in that direction. And if you got above the thing, the signal would collapse. And then it'd be behind you, you see. And so you're not looking out. You're just watching the bubble. And all of a sudden you say, right, it's gone. It's behind us, 100 yards back there. And then turn around and you should
so
be able to see.
Overshoot and then go back.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless, of course, the pilot was... I mean, the pilot is looking anyway. You're the one that's sort of into the dope scope. Mm. But if it was at night or the person was hidden or anything, yes, that's the way you check.
Was there a lot of night flying going on?
No, not. I mean, they practiced. Once they'd started doing it, each pilot had to have 2 hours night flying or 3 hours or something like that per month. Because hours were fairly limited because of the amount of operations we were doing. I mean, with 14 aircraft. They were constantly sort of having to go in for minor and major servicings and things like this. And we had quite a few pilots, but you'd get a lot of intense flying when there was an operation, and then it would go quiet and they'd just do the odd training trips.
What happened then after Harding went and Sir Hewfoot came out and the emphasis shifted from military to political solutions?
Well, I think things tended... I think Field Marshal Harding had done a good job. I think we were starting to win anyway. But... obviously the political situation as it was, they brought in a politician, and from then on we still carried on much the same, but it wasn't I think there were less incidents after Hugh Foote took over, and more sort of diplomacy.
So did the flying tail off when that during that period, the operational flying?
I would have thought so, yes. The island was getting back to normal, having had all these troops there and squadrons and so on, that I think, yes, it was definitely sort of graded down. Yeah.
How many of the men on that list of 30, that poster, then had been taken, do you think, by the time the active military operations were beginning to die away?
I wouldn't like to say, but I would have... I can remember going into the air crew room and there was one of these posters on the wall, and it there were red crosses, and week by week there'd be another red cross go up. They caught him so-and-so. Not necessarily killed or anything, but they'd caught... And if I hazarded a guess, I'd say about 50%. Had red crosses on, but that's only a guess.
What about the aftermath of the Suez operation, when it was aborted, the invasion of Egypt was aborted and we withdrew? Did that cause a great deal of activity?
I can't really remember. I know you see we had a lot of naval sort of involvement. There was gannets and things like that, and I can remember these wrecked helicopters coming back, but and I believe there was a lot of troop movement, sort of every day there was Britannias and Beverleys and things flying out, but it seemed to wind down fairly quickly, I think, after the Suez sort of packed in.
How much warning did you have of your next posting?
The thing is that in those days I had come to the Middle East Air Force from Bomber Command.
Yes.
And the only chance you had of changing commands was after an overseas tour, and I can't remember where you were sort of asked if you had any preference to the part of the country you were wanting to be posted to, or the type of work. And I seem to remember that I wanted to go to Middle Wallop, Old Sarum, or Little Risington. Now, because of the helicopter experience, or they were good numbers, those three stations, very small stations.
You wanted to carry on with helicopters?
Well, yes, I had an idea that I'd like to carry on. But I was posted to Transport Command, and I was posted to Dishforth, which is over in on the A1 in North Yorkshire there. And no sign of helicopters. They were Beverley aircraft. And at this time... they discovered that doing these long-range transportation jobs with aircraft like Britannias and the Beverley, which was never really designed for long haul, there was always problems if the aircraft went unserviceable en route. And someone in their wisdom said, right, what we're going to do is all the way around the world on these staging posts, we will have specialists on Comets, Britannias and Beverleys, so that when one of them is in sort of staging through. If there's any problems, at least we've got a man there that can describe the problem accurately and possibly fix it.
A diagnostician.
Yes, yeah. So I, for my sins, was at Dishforth on these Beverleys, and I was on 242 OCU, which was training aircrew for flying on Beverley squadrons.
Had you worked on Beverleys before?
No. And but I'd worked on big aircraft and similar engines. Have you?
Did you have to do a sort of conversion course for work on the Beverley?
No. What normally happens when you go onto a new aircraft, you go onto the squadron and you've got to wait for the next convenient manufacturer's course. Now, this might be 6 months, it might be 3 months. You might be lucky and go straight on the manufacturer's course, but normally there are local courses, particularly if there's a, say, on the engine, then you would be taken to the engine bay and given a check over the engine so that you know where things are and how things work. But to do a manufacturer's course was quite an expensive thing, and they had to be sure that you were going to be, having done the course, that they were going to get the money's worth out of you. So what used to happen, you'd get on to the squadron and you might be employed on first line, second line, or in the servicing bays. And once they sort of checked you over and said, oh, this is the man we want for deeper servicing or something, then you would be sent on the appropriate course. So I went there and I was there for a year, and I didn't do a manufacturer's course, but an engine's an engine, and you soon pick up from the other tradesmen, your contemporaries. They show you how the easy way to do this job and so on. And once you've done the job once or twice, then it comes naturally. And I just fitted onto the squadron. All the expertise who showed me what to do were all of a sudden posted onto these route stations. So-and-so was going to Bahrain and all the rest of it. And I became one of the more experienced, having only been on them for a year, but I was one of the more experienced.
So you'd really learned on the job from your senior colleagues.
That's right.
And then you were the senior man.
Well, I wouldn't...
One of the senior men.
When you say senior, it doesn't work on seniority, but it works. I was one of the most experienced left. And then they posted me. Now, I was still a corporal, and it's unusual for a corporal to be posted by name. Usually what happens is they're just directed, post one corporal engine fitter to such and such. Mm. Anyway, unbeknown to me, I was posted by name, and I was posted to Northolt. Well, the orderly room, in their wisdom, sort of said, hey, we don't want to lose this man because he's the only one that's got any experience. What we'll do, we'll post this corporal down. So a friend of mine who was a corporal was told that he was posted to Northolt. So as they do, we all get to the corporal's club, and he puts on a barrel of beer and says cheerio, and out of the camp gates he goes. We'd had a good night. 2 days later, he's back up at Dishforth saying, I shouldn't have been posted. The posting was for Roper. So they sort of said, no, you don't post corporals by name, you see. Anyway, when they found out, I'd been posted to Northolt because Northolt also was Transport Command, and they had got some sycamores. And what they'd done, they'd been through all the people on Transport Command. They needed people with sycamore experience, and there was three of us. And we'd all been posted into Northolt. And so that was... they had to let me go. I didn't mind being posted.